My name is Malkia Amala Cyril, and I give my permission to broadcast and edit this interview.
Thank you so much. And just so you know, if you say something later on, and you know, like you think back on it next week and go, oh, you know, maybe I don't want that, just let me know, okay?
Okay.
So I was reading a little bit about your work background. I was just wondering, what is your position now at the, is it the Center for Social Media or Social Justice?
My organization is called the Center for Media Justice, and...
Oh, I was just wondering what your position was.
So the organization is the Center for Media Justice, and I am the co-founder and executive director, and I also co-founded the Media Action Grassroots Network.
Wonderful, wonderful. What is it that you focus on specifically?
So we're building a movement of the unheard to transform media and digital policies, ensure fairness and freedom for people of color in a digital age. And right now, we're working heavily on issues of surveillance and digital privacy, working a lot on issues of net neutrality and free speech online, working to protect communities of color from harassment and censorship online. Those are some of the things that we're working on right now.
I wanted to ask a little bit more about your personal background, and I understand that your mom was part of the Black Panthers in New York.
Yes, she was. My mom was a Black Panther in Brooklyn, in Harlem, meaning the New York chapter. My father was also a Black Panther. He was a Panther actually in Oakland, and moved over to New York. My father was a member of the BLA, Black Liberation Army. My mother was a member of the Black Panther Party.
And what did they do, you know, for the Black Panthers?
Well, my father, I don't really know him, so I can talk about my mom, though. My mom was an editor in the Panther newspaper. She coordinated the breakfast program, and she was often the person who provided housing and jobs to many of the Panthers who, you know, after coming out of jail or, you know, people worked as Panthers full time. So a lot of times they didn't have apartments, they didn't have, other kinds of jobs because they were working full time as activists for no pay. And so my mom would support many different people as they did that. So they all often joked, if anybody was going to have an apartment and a job, it was going to be Janet Cyril. So that was her role.
I think that often, especially now, there may not be as much remembrance from, you know, newer generations, and sometimes the Black Panthers may have been misunderstood. I was just wondering what you think. Do you think that they're misunderstood now in history, or what's the most misunderstood aspect of the Black Panthers?
Black people and Black communities are misunderstood largely. The trope of criminalization has followed Black communities deliberately as a result of white supremacy for centuries. And so Black leaders or Black activists who rise up, who resist and who stand in opposition to white supremacy, in opposition to how colonialism manifests in this day and age, they're definitely going to be misunderstood. They're going to be, stereotyped by mainstream media, which happened to the Black Panther Party. They're going to be, talked about as sure as you're born. And that's a song. Anyway, the point is that Black communities at large are stereotyped and criminalized, and Black activists are just a manifestation of that. It's not that the Black Panther Party in particular was criminalized. They weren't criminalized any more than Malcolm X was criminalized, any more than ultimately Martin Luther King was criminalized. All of these Black activists were the subject, for example, of J. Edgar Hoover's COINTELPRO, counterintelligence program. All of these Black activists were stereotyped in mainstream media. So was the Black Panther Party misunderstood? Yes, absolutely, as a result of deliberate misrepresentation.
What was it like for you as a child of an activist during that time?
Well, you know, they call us Panther Cubs. And for me, for my younger sister, and for many of the people that I grew up with who are in my generation, whose parents were Panthers, it was terrifying. On the one hand, knowing that our parents were subjected to, regularly subjected to illegal searches and seizures, regularly subjected to wiretapping, it was scary. It was scary growing up knowing that those people who you called your uncles and aunties, some of them were living in prison and might be in prison for the rest of their lives. It was scary. But it wasn't only scary. It was also amazing. It was outstanding to, instead of going to whatever stuff regular kids did, we went to court. We went to court on a regular basis. My first poem, which I wrote when I was 5, was about the Haitian boat people. I recited it to my mom, and she took the notes as I sat on her shoulders at a protest, about Haitians being turned away by the Coast Guard in New York. And so, the experience of growing up with a parent who was determined to ensure that her children would understand why the conditions for Black people were the way they were, and that we would not blame ourselves for those conditions. We would see clearly who the responsible parties were, and then we would work to change it. So growing up as a Panther Cub meant that I was, in a very deliberate way, given, I think, agency, given will, given the understanding, not only the ability to analyze and understand the conditions, but the will to change them. And I think that that's something that our educational system actively denies to Black children every day. And I feel very blessed, very lucky to have that in my life.
Wow, that was great what you just said. What an incredible childhood you had. And I like the idea of the poetry too, your first poem carrying you through your life. Were there very many Asian Americans where you were growing up at all, or was there a community?
Oh, no. Mm-mm. No, I mean, New York, Brooklyn is highly segregated. For example, if you lived in Sunset Park, you might see some Asian folks, but in Bed-Stuy, the only Asian people you was going to see is if somebody owned a store, right? And there was a lot of tension. In poor black communities, people did not understand, for example, anything about zoning laws, anything about, how banks were particularly discriminating against Asian business owners by placing, by only giving them loans to do business in Black communities. You know what I'm saying? Like all of the forces behind the tensions between Blacks and Asian communities in New York City were largely unseen, and I think deliberately so. So there were not very many Asian people living where I lived in Bedford-Stuyvesant, which was the largest Black community in the country, actually, at the time.
Was there very much tension between the two communities?
There was tons of tension between Blacks and Asians in Brooklyn in particular. And I know that that was mirrored in many large cities throughout the nation. Besides the economic divide that we witness and experience, right, with Asian people being perceived as business owners, right, and Black people being perceived as welfare recipients, and that's the relationship, right, that emerged. So you have this perception of Asian utility, Asians being useful, being good. Basically, you might say good niggas, right? House niggas. And then you got Black people being bad, being criminal, being useless, and therefore caged as criminals, and caged in prisons. And that dynamic, that those tropes, I think both served white supremacy well in the 80s and the 70s when I was growing up, and they served white supremacy well today. So was there tension? Absolutely. There was also interesting cooperation, particularly in relationship to the police, but more tension than cooperation for sure.
Can you give me an example of that cooperation?
Well, I can tell you about my experience, which is different than I think most other people's experience in my neighborhood. My house was called the International House, you know, and my mom, they called it a professor. My mom was the first person to have a computer on our block. She worked at LaGuardia Community College. And one of the things that she did was she would engage and invite women from all over the world to come to stay at our home, you know. So we would have, women, you know, Indian women who were coming in from London, for example, staying at our house. All kind of people, you know what I mean, from all over the country and all over the world, excuse me. And one of the things, one of the reasons for that is that one of my mom's very good friends and someone who I grew up loving and knowing as my auntie is Yuri Kochiam. And I would spend, you know, many, many evenings in her Harlem apartment, you know, which was just full to the brim of paper. I never seen nobody house with that much paper before. But she just had newspapers and all kind of papers in her house. And, you know, we would sit there under the table listening to their meetings and along with the other kids. And because of that relationship, because of that friendship, you know, I think that, and not only that friendship, but that was one of the more informative ones. My mom's perspective was that of an internationalist. And so my house was full of Asian people. But that was unusual. That was an unusual experience. That was not a typical black experience for anyone that I knew. But I will say another, you know, so that's my experience of kind of like cooperation is through really the remnants of the Black Panther Party. The Black Panther Party for all, you know, everyone talked about how nationalist the Black Panther Party was. But in fact, it wasn't nationalist at all. It was an internationalist organization, very much so. You know, the Black Panther Party was all about collaborating with the Asian left, the Latino left, you know, the white left, Native American, indigenous left, all across these lines and borders. And so, you know, so the trope about this narrow cultural black nationalism that I think mainstream media and law enforcement attempted to paint the Black Panther Party as was really to disrupt those opportunities, to disrupt those points of collaboration and alliance building that were so very effective. The other point of collaboration that I'll say is obviously, you know, children who, you know, on the one hand, talk much mess, you know, repeat what they hear from television or their parents. But also, you know, in the schools I went to, I was tracked early on into AP classes, advanced placement, by my mom. Like, the school didn't track me. Moms was very clear, you need to be in these advanced classes. And in those advanced classes were a lot of Asian kids. And so me being one of very few black people, and they being where there were more Asian people, but still in a minority in relationship to the number of white folks in those classes, together we kind of bonded, you know, as the people of color in those classes. And it was the first time that I actually felt an identity as a person of color instead of simply as a black person. And that was important to me as well.
What an amazing background there and upbringing you had. Just on a personal level, I was just curious, what was Yuri Kochiyama like from your perspective as a child?
What was she like? Yuri was brilliant. She was passionate. She would cuss you out and she would hug you up. She was extremely passionate. She loved her people, and her people were so many different kinds of people. Her people was the left, and she had a particular commitment to black lives, I think in part because she understood very deeply, in a way very few others do, that model minority framework or stereotype is built on the back of a criminal minority stereotype. The two stereotypes can only exist in relationship to one another. And so, and she understood that, I think, very early before the interrogation of the model minority concept became a, something that was happening on a regular basis. I felt like she was doing that. And so she wasn't, I didn't find her to be like hugely like an academic, but she was deeply brilliant, full-bodied brilliant, and she understood these ideas, I think, before many other people did.
Well, thank you for that memory. I just think your upbringing was so amazing. How has that affected the work that you do today?
Well, you know, being a Panther Cub, but not just any Panther Cub, being my mother's child, I'm an internationalist too. In fact, my mom was vicious about her internationalism. I remember being a child, maybe about 8 or something like that, 9, you know, and it was the times, it was the 80s. Actually, it must have been the late 70s, early 80s. And my mom sent me to the store to buy her a pack of cigarettes. You know, that's how we did it. It's Brooklyn. And I went to the store, and I came back, and I had some type of interaction with the store owner, and I called him an Arab. And my mom said, "You did what?" And I said, "Yeah, that Arab, he did this, that, and the other thing." And my mom said, "Oh, okay." And so she took my hand, we went back to the store, and she said, "Yeah, tell him what you told me." And I just stood there. I was stuck, you know. She said, "No, call him what you just called him to me when we were back at the house." And I knew it was wrong, and so I couldn't say it. I started crying. And she was very serious. She had no sympathy. She said, no. "If you feel you can use the term Arab in private, you should be very comfortable to use it in public. And if you're not comfortable using it in public, you certainly shouldn't be using it in private." And that's how she was, you know. She constantly corrected and made it clear that human rights belong to everyone, that dignity belonged to everyone, and it was my responsibility to give that to every single person I met, regardless of their background. So I think that just made it clear to me, one, my fight is for all people, number one. Number two, my mother was a Marxist, and so she also imparted to me the importance of a class analysis and being able to understand, for example, why, you know, living in a digital economy today, how that affects our ability to, how it affects justice, how it affects fairness, how it affects the political landscape. It matters, right? Class matters. She was someone who, you know, some of my first books were, you know, fans were reading Wretched of the Earth and reading poems by Langston Hughes in Liberation Bookstore, sitting on her lap. And so she imparted to me the importance of history, the importance of geography, and all of this has shaped, you know, my consciousness, my commitment to Black communities today, my commitment to other communities of color today, my belief that, you know, my understanding of the relationship between the land and liberation. All of these are things that my mother gave to me. And the last thing that I'll say in terms of how it shaped, how my upbringing has shaped my consciousness and who I am today, is because my mother was not just a Panther, was not just an internationalist, was not just a Marxist, but she was also a writer. She was a poet. She was a lover of words. She was a lover of music. She believed in art. And for that reason, I found my home in fighting for media justice, fighting for digital freedom, fighting against those that would take away the free speech, human rights of communities of color. That's where I found my home. That's what I believe. That's where I do my work. And she is the reason why.
Amazing. Thank you for that. Good words to live by, definitely. I was wondering, you know, you grew up with the idea of fighting white supremacy, and you have been devoting your life to this. And I was wondering, has the fight against white supremacy changed over time for you?
Has the fight against white supremacy changed over time? I think that white supremacy, one of its characteristics is its enduring nature. So I think there are aesthetic shifts. It looks different. It feels different. There are no water fountains labeled white and colored anymore. Today, they are labeled woman and man, and those who don't fit those characteristics can't go in. You know, white supremacy changes his face, but it don't change his heart. It don't change his structure. It don't change his bones. It's the same beast. And so, you know, people are always talking about how we have to find new ways to fight. But I think that there ain't nothing new under the sun, really. I mean, the way that enslaved Africans fought white supremacy at a time when their ability to fight was limited is just as valid as the way our enslaved Africans who are in prison right now are fighting white supremacy despite limited mobility and limited freedom. I think that, the economy has shifted and changed. You know, there are things that are different, I guess is what I'm saying, but the core relations of power, they haven't changed. They haven't changed at all. I mean, the fact is right now, the reason an authoritarian president like Trump could rise to power today is because of white supremacy's enduring nature. It's because white nationalism is at the heart of this nation's founding. It's at the heart of every policy, every rule book that structures how we run this country. And not only this country, if I'm gonna be an internationalist in terms of resistance and oppression, then I have to also have an international understanding of how this oppression came to be. The nature of colonialism, the fact that Europe stole so much from Africa, so much from India, so much from East Asia, so much from what is now considered to be the Americas in order to produce the kind of wealth that it has today, in order to produce America. So I think like that history is manifest today. So when we ask the question, has white supremacy changed? No, it ain't changed. It changed his makeup. You know, it changed the color of his hair. But it's still the same beast.
Would you talk about the early days? I mean, I want to talk more about, you know, the future and the response to the current administration. But for right now, I'd like to just kind of focus on the early days of the Black Lives Matter movement and how were you involved in it and how did it all coalesce?
Well, you know, it's hard to talk about the early days of the Black Lives Matter movement. Because when I say BLM, I'm talking about the Black Liberation Movement. And that's been around for a very long time. Black Lives Matter, the work that happened in the uprising in Ferguson, on the uprisings that have happened in Baltimore, Chicago, and all over this country, the birth of the Black Lives Matter Network, all of these things are part of a long lineage, you know, of Black resistance and fighting for liberation. So I don't think about it quite in those terms, you know, the early days of the Black Lives Matter movement, but I know what you mean. So what I'll say is this: in 2012, you know, when Trayvon Martin was killed and George Zimmerman was acquitted for his murder, Black Lives Matter formed a national network. But before that, Michael Brown had been killed, and the people of Ferguson rose up in response to that killing. The fact is that you can look back to Watts, and you can look back to every Black urban rebellion across the history of this nation, and they've all been in response to the murder of a young black person or of a black person. So I think that that one, there are no early days. There's only the latest days. Yeah. And two, it was painful, you know, how technology and rebellion cross paths to reveal the systematic murder of black bodies by law enforcement, a systematic murder, set of murders that had been going on for a very long time, but technology helped to show it to a larger audience. And in 2010, 2011, 2012, technology really did its work, right? Mobile phones began showing to a very wide audience how easy it was for a black person to die at the hands of law enforcement or at the hands of vigilantes playing law enforcement, in the case of Michael Brown and George Zimmerman. So it was painful. It was a painful beginning, right? It was chaotic. It was amazing to watch the people of Ferguson, people who, these are not professional activists. These were not people who were paid in any way by nonprofits to stand out in that weather and risk their lives and their freedom fighting for their lives and their freedom. These were just angry people who wanted some justice. And so that for me was extraordinarily inspirational. It was incredible. And from there, you know, there are places across this country where there's a lot of nonprofit and organizing infrastructure. Many organizers decided to go to Ferguson and try to be of service, try to bring some of what we've learned through organizing campaigns in the past to that space. Some of that was well received, some of it wasn't, but I know that the fact is the folks in Ferguson have gone on to win real victories. And I think that out of that rebellion came a realization that we needed to do more, and that it wasn't about one place, one city, right? This was happening in every city, in every place. And the Black Lives Matter Network, kind of in a parallel way, was born. And the Black Lives Matter Network, you know, has chapters across this country. You know, it's unique in part because it carries the legacy of the Black Panther Party forward. The Black Lives Matter Network speaks for and is of those who are pushed to the margins of even black movements, right? So queer folks, trans folks, women, children, you know, those who are poor, those who are in prison. You know, this is not about a narrow cultural nationalism. This moment, the political moment that we were in 2012, was a moment where many different things were able to converge. You know, those who were technologists, who were eager to use those tools to expose these human rights abuses, and those who were living on the street, you know, queer and trans youth living on the street who were victims of those human rights abuses, who had historically been left out of movements for Black liberation, were now able to be at the forefront. So this moment that we were in 2012, where we saw the breakdown, I won't say the breakdown, because the systems were doing exactly what they're set up to do, but what we saw, the failure of the justice system, you know, so obviously, so in such raw form. And at the same time, it emboldened those who have been pushed to the margins, so far to the margins that there was nowhere left to go, so they moved to the center. And I think that that's something that was just, it was an amazing time. I will say that it was an amazing time, and it continues to be an amazing time today.
Do you think that, I mean, it sounds like the movement has been very intentional about remembering the lives of Black women and Black trans people. Do you think this international consciousness, you know, has played into how effective the Black Lives Matter movement has been?
Yes, I mean, the Black Lives Matter Network and the movement for Black lives in general is an internationalist movement. It's not just internationalist, though, in ideology. It's literally an international movement, meaning that, you know, we got chapters in Canada, we got chapters in the UK, there are chapters throughout Africa, there are chapters in Brazil. I mean, there are chapters all over the world. And I think that it's important to note that, right? Internationalism is one thing as an ideology, but actually having an international movement where Black Lives Matter is the chant, you know, on the streets in London, that matters. That matters. Because what we know as well as every other Black person, every person all over the world, if you really interrogate it, everybody knows that Black has been constructed as the worst possible thing you can be. In every society, in every culture, in every part of this planet, if you out in the sun, you know, if you are, I don't care what city you in any city in Asia, there's a darker set of people who are considered lesser, right? There are darker people all over this world that are considered lesser because Black has been framed as the worst thing you can be. And so, you know, racism is international, white supremacy is international, anti-Blackness is international, so the resistance against those things has to also be international.
I think that's incredible that it's all over the world as far as a movement, and I certainly didn't realize that, so thank you for telling me that. I was asking about the intersectional consciousness, about including more women, including trans people in the movement. I think it's interesting that, you know, there are so many women involved. In fact, wasn't it founded by women?
Absolutely. The Black Lives Matter Network was founded by three women, two of whom are queer, and I think that that matters. I think that, though, what's true is that, you know, the rank and file of the Black Panther Party was largely female. And that's not known, you know, to most people. It was just the public leadership that was more male, but the rank and file membership was more than 75% women. So women have been leading Black liberation movements from the beginning. You know what I'm saying? Harriet Tubman lives on. We've been doing this for a very long time. I do think that the inclusion as frontline leadership of queer and trans people is a brand new thing. And I think that it's an absolutely critical thing because queer people been shaping these movements for a very long time but ain't been at the front in leadership. So I think that that is an incredibly powerful and incredibly important thing. Mostly because of this. It's not for some essentialist reason. You know, it's because the further you are to the margins, if we can ensure those at the furthest out, right, furthest in the margins get their rights, that those people are able to live to their highest dignity, their best potential, all of what they deserve, they are able to have. Well, guess what? Everyone else will get that too. And that's a targeted universalism. That's a concept of targeted universalism. And it's the idea that those with the least, if you serve them, actually everyone gets served. If you serve only those with the most, then most people get left out. So I think that it's not simply about the inclusion of queer and trans people in leadership. It's not, again, it's not an essentialist issue. It's not because we're queer or because we're trans. It's because we have been denied our basic human rights and as Black people, and that as Black people who are queer and trans, when we are lifted, so are all other Black people. That's the essence of why intersectionalism matters. It isn't because just everybody needs to be included. It's because those with the least can ensure that more and more people get what they need.
Has that affected the leadership style in the Black Lives Matter movement?
It's absolutely affected the leadership style. And again, I want to differentiate between the larger movement for Black Lives and the Black Lives Matter Network, which is a very specific organization.
Oh, okay. So is the network in San Francisco then, or in the Bay Area?
Like I mentioned earlier, the network is an international network. Yeah, and there's chapters all over the world. But people interchange the words Black Lives Matter because it's a slogan. And they think, oh, that means everything in the movement. But actually, there's a network called Black Lives Matter that was created after the acquittal of George Zimmerman for the murder of Trayvon Martin in 2012. And then there are other organizations, many others, including Black Youth Project, including Million Hoodies Movement for Justice, Dream Defenders, Organization for Black Struggle in Ferguson, in St. Louis. There are many, many organizations in the movement for Black Lives. But Black Lives Matter is one of those organizations.
That helps a lot. So I guess we were talking about just the leadership style itself.
It's definitely affected the leadership style of the Black Lives Matter Network, and I think of many organizations within the movement for Black Lives. One, leadership in this moment is largely decentralized. There are many leaders, not one. And while some of those leaders are on television more than others, for the most part, in every city, there are leaders at the local level that are being heard, that are being seen, and that are really doing the work in their own cities. That's different than what was once true. There's no single national figurehead. There are many different people in leadership today. I think it's also affected the leadership style in that, you know, even those who are on television do not purport, at least for the most part, to speak for those who are not. You know, they offer an analysis, they offer an approach and a perspective. But again, many people who are speaking, you know, on some of these national shows are making it very clear, this is an analysis and a perspective, but if you want to know how queer and trans people feel, for example, about this issue, you need to go talk to them. So I think that there's some real respect going on now that I don't think has always been true. And then the last way that I think it's affected the leadership style is I think that, you know, let's be real, but cooperation, collaboration is actually a very old approach to leadership within African and African American communities. And so it's not something that is new. And it's not something that has emerged directly as a result of intersectionality. But I will say that having many women in leadership, having many queer people in leadership, having many trans people in leadership absolutely changes the nature of collaboration. It increases the amount of collaboration. It increases the will for collaboration. So I find it to be highly collaborative, highly decentralized, and more respectful as a result of the intersectionality.
It seems so inclusive. And I was talking, I talked with Ellen Choi last week about Asians for Black Lives. And it seemed like there is quite a bit of support and cooperation within, you know, different ethnic groups. Do you know of ways, I just wanted to localize it to the Bay Area, that the Black Lives Matter Network has turned to allies like Asians for Black Lives? I mean, for support, has that you know, how do you work together?
Yeah, that's a great question. So when members of the Black Lives Matter Bay Area team, you know, stopped some BART trains, I don't know if you remember that, right, at the West Oakland station, and they put their freedom on the line not only for Black liberation, but, you know, this was on Black Friday, so this was also for all workers, all low-wage workers. And Asians for Black Lives, from that point forward, became an integral part of the defense committee process. So Asians for Black Lives hosted many rallies. Asians for Black Lives was an incredible solidarity team for these individuals that have put their freedom on the line. Because obviously, once you've taken that kind of civil disobedience, it'd be difficult to do more after that, especially because now you're in court, right? And you're on trial for the crime. So, or for what the court is calling a crime. And it was because we had the solidarity of Asians for Black Lives, also Bay Rising, which was at the time largely white folks, you know, who were standing in to offer solidarity, and others who were able to really stand up and be a front line for those folks that have put themselves on the line. So that kind of solidarity, I think, while we have in the Bay been cultivating that, I think, for decades, you know, whether it's, you know, the work of the Chinese Progressive Association or others, where we have worked closely, you know what I mean, on various campaigns, this level of active solidarity in the face of civil disobedience, I feel like it's something that really emerged during this time, and I felt like it was necessary, it was right, and it is the result of a long standing effort at collaboration. So this, I guess, what I'm trying to say is, it didn't come out of the woodwork, it didn't emerge from nothing. It wasn't just some well-meaning Asian people was like, let's do this right now. This was part of a long-standing commitment to solidarity, Black Asian solidarity, that has been grown in here in the Bay. It's homegrown. And I think that this is something that actually is a model, you know, and should be a model for places across this country.
I think definitely it should be a model, just the way groups do work together and everything that you've described about the leadership style for the Black Lives Matter Network. I think all of that would make a great model. I hope that you can kind of create a template or something in the future. I know there's so much to do.
Well, Fred Hampton created the template. You know, Fred Hampton of the Black Panther Party created the template. You know, he already laid out how we build solidarity, you know what I mean? He said, we don't fight racism with racism, we fight it with solidarity. And that's kind of the approach that we've taken is, you know, we fight white supremacy with multiracial solidarity. And that's, and I think that if more organizations can adopt that approach, I think that we actually have a chance of winning maybe something big in our lifetime.
One of the things I was wondering about, Robin was telling me that the Black Lives Matter, I guess, is it network or just itself, has six overarching demands in its platform. I was just wondering about these demands and, you know, how you see them changing under a Trump presidency.
The movement for Black Lives, which is, again, a larger set of, a larger coalition of organizations, has created a platform, a policy platform called the Vision for Black Lives. And the demands in that platform cross every issue area. So there are demands around education, public education. There are demands around housing. There are demands around jobs and living wage. There are demands around media, technology, an end to mass surveillance. There are demands across every issue area. The big challenge is that, you know, one good example here is our demands around an adequate education, public education, are, we see now, being eroded, not met. We know that Trump, otherwise known as 45, has promised to and is in the process of advancing school choice instead of advancing a 21st century public education. So, that's just one way in which the current administration is devolving black freedom, is eroding civil rights, not just for black people, but for all people. And education is only one area. The same is true in the healthcare system. We already know that Trump Care will deny millions of people health insurance. My wife has cancer. I am opposed to Trump Care, not simply on an ideological level, but on a personal level, because it will affect our family. So there, on every issue, whether we're talking about the cuts that he's made to HUD, housing and urban development, whether we're talking about the rules that he intends to pass, or the executive orders that he's already put out there to strengthen protections for police while weakening any investigations into police corruption and violence at the Justice Department. Like, on every level, every single thing that the Movement for Black Lives has attempted to win, he is committed to eroding. And not simply him, but a Republican Congress, a Republican White House is attempting to erode. So we have our work cut out for us.
Do you feel even more motivated now? Because it does feel like we're going backwards.
Do I feel more motivated now? No, I don't. I don't feel any less committed to struggle than I did before Trump was in office. And I don't feel any more committed to struggle than I did before Trump was in office. Because, like I said, white supremacy is an enduring beast. Trump is just the latest face. Him and his administration is a dangerous face, no doubt. Him and his administration absolutely changes the game. It's not exactly the same. I don't want to be confusing and make it seem as though it is. It's not. But it's also not wholly different either. And I think that it's really important for us to understand that even President Obama, who I voted for both times, he was the face of white supremacy, that these are structures, not individuals. They're not about personalities, they're about power. And so this is a marathon, And so I don't feel like I need to go crazy and put myself in harm's way or danger or do anything that doesn't allow me to understand. I'm trying to work beyond the 4 or 8 years we might see Trump. I'm trying to do this work for a long time, just like I've been doing it for a long time. So for me, no, I don't feel more motivated today than I did yesterday. And I don't feel any less motivated today than I will tomorrow. I'm motivated toward freedom. And I'm motivated toward freedom every day.
I guess what motivates you? Why are you personally committed to this activism?
Why am I personally committed to this activism? I think number one, because my mama told me to, and I do what my mom tells me to do. My mother passed away in 2005 from sickle cell anemia. And, having a genetic disease that is going to kill you definitely shapes how you live. And part of how she lived was urgently. And she was very clear with me and my sister that if you ain't fighting for freedom, you ain't doing nothing. So that's number one. I'm committed to it because my mama told me to. Number two, I'm committed to it because I really understand that my family can't go on without it. My sister runs a school in New York, in Brooklyn, called Little Maroons. It's a preschool that focuses on, it's a child-centered, African-centered school. And my sister is also a member of the Malcolm X grassroots movement. You know, my niece goes to Howard University. And, you know, my other niece goes to Temple. Like, my nieces are in college trying to, again, survive as Black women in this country. My wife, a Black woman in this country, has cancer, trying to navigate the medical industry. You know, we, our daily lives depend on the victory of the things that I am working on. So it's not an amorphous ideological fight for me. It's I'm fighting for my actual survival. As a queer person, you know, when I grew up in the 80s as a butch, as a Black butch, you know, I came out when I was 12 and a half. And I've had the opportunity. My mom dragged me to the Medgar Evers Black Writers Conference when I was 13 and put me in front of Barbara Smith and Audre Lorde and Paula Giddings and Black writers of the day, and took me to the mic by my shirt and told me to tell them you're a lesbian, you know? And I did. And she said, tell them you want to be a writer. And I did. And then I had the opportunity to be mentored, you know, by Audre Lorde as a result of that advocacy. So there ain't nothing in my spirit, there ain't nothing in my history that would ever lead me away from this movement, you know. Even now, as me and my wife, you know, work together to battle cancer, stage 4 cancer, it only brings me closer to the fight for freedom. It only makes me want it more. Because if I win, she lives. That's how I look at it. If we win, she gets the best medical care possible. If we win, she gets to have everything that a human being needs to survive in the world. And the same for my nieces and the same for my sister. And they get to all have what my mom did not get to have. My mom died. And we get to live right now. And then our children, you know, the children that we leave behind when we pass on, they get to live and get to have those things too. So that's what motivates me. That's why I do this for them.
Very inspiring. I'm just very moved by everything that you've said. I'm wondering, just for as a final question, and again, I appreciate everything that you said. It's been great talking with you. I just wanted to kind of bring it on back to, you know, the relationship between Asian Americans and African Americans and how we can work on it. How can we work together better? If you had any advice, especially for young activists in working together in across communities with, you know, the Asian American, African American, I guess all of the communities, but that's my focus. What would your advice be?
I think my advice would be, you know, we didn't get here alone. The systems that oppress us, they oppress us all. And let me say it differently. You know, if Britain had not been able to steal from India, it could not have helped finance an international slave trade. If Britain did not have the, you know, Portugal was not able to steal from what we now call the Americas, South America, Mexico, and all of these places. If Spain was not able to colonize in these regions, we would not have had an international transatlantic slave trade. The point I'm making is that we are all complicit. We're all tied together, both in terms of our humanity, but also in terms of our oppression. You know, we got here together, and the only way we get out of here is together. My life depends upon the lives of, you know, children in Vietnam and in Thailand. Like, the fact of the matter is, right now, for example, every cell phone you use, you know, somebody somewhere in some other country put that thing together. You know, and when it is gone, and most likely that person was in Asia, and when that cell phone gets destroyed, that e-waste is going to somewhere in Africa. The point is that everything we touch right? We're in a global economy, but we're just in a global society. Everything we touch touches somebody else. And so you can't win your liberation by yourself. It's not possible. You need all of those people who are affected by those systems to stand up together. And the only way you get that is if you stand down for a minute and listen. Listen to what people's experiences have been. Listen to them in their own words, in their own languages. Recognize that colonialism, especially in America, is very different than how it is every place else in the world. The fact is that when I lived in the Caribbean, people spoke 3, 4, 5 languages. You know, I was the only one who couldn't understand anything that was going on because I was from the United States. We have to understand that part of imperialism is about keeping you dumb, keeping you without your tongue, without your native tongue, but also without nobody else's either. So you can't understand what else is happening. You know, people all over the world can tell you who your president is, who the presidents are of multiple other countries, and countries we don't even know exist. So I think that, you know, stand down and listen. Stand down and learn. Read books. Learn geography. Listen. And then that listening, that ability to stand down in humility will give you the opportunity to stand up together in resistance.